I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, The New Yorker's Kella Fasana talks to Mark Bauerlein, a professor at Emory University and editor at the religious journal First Things. Bauerlein believes that the election of Donald Trump represents an antidote to the culture of political correctness on college campuses.
So, Kay, you've been working on a piece about Trumpism, the politics of Donald Trump, and how conservatives of all different stripes are responding to him. You recently talked with a writer by the name of Mark Bauerlein. Who is he, and why did you want to talk to him?
Well, for obvious reasons, we've been hearing a lot about Trumpism and what Trump believes. And a lot of what we've been hearing, almost all of it, has come from people who criticize Trump, people who are skeptical about him. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to some of the scholars and intellectuals who are actually excited about Trump. Mark Bauerlein is an English professor at Emory University. He's a senior editor at First Things, which was a center for kind of erudite scholarship about the intersection of religion and culture.
It was very close to the Reagan administration.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So Bauerlein himself represents what?
Well, like a lot of people, he had kind of a complicated journey to where he is. He grew up as what he describes as a liberal and found himself kind of drifting into more conservative beliefs as he kind of got disillusioned with liberal politics. And then even now, he's somewhat at odds with some of the other people at First Things, the journal where he works, because a number of the people there were opposed to Trump. So for him, it's part of a lifelong political evolution.
My parents idolized Martin Luther King. I was raised with ideas of integration. You don't hear that word much anymore. That was the word in the 60s. You never heard the word diversity. And we didn't highlight differences. We actually highlighted the underlying unity. Right, my parent, their phrase was, everyone is the same underneath. So that, you know, you live next to a black family, you live next to a Mexican family, you may dislike certain things, but we're here together. And that makes certain common grounds. But one of the things that started to distress me in academia was the rise of identity politics, which I thought this is contrary to that universal integrative message of Martin Luther King. And to me, there was an insistence about it that I found destructive, that actually leads to disunity, forms of suspicion, and of cynicism and tribalism. And I just, you know, in my mid-40s, I just started shifting. And I adopted some conservative outlooks on social and personal issues. I have returned the Catholic Church, but I still live very much in sort of a strong liberal intellectual world in the university.
I could imagine when you tell me your story and you talk about how I remember reading a blog post you wrote about someone cursing on an airplane that you were on and kind of confronting them. And now you've got this presidential candidate talking about bombing the bleep out of ISIS.
I
see you briefly have your hand over your face, but I could imagine that someone like you would see the rise of Donald Trump within the Republican Party and be kind of horrified.
No, I wasn't. I mean, we all cringe, of course, over the language and some of the boorishness, and you say, no, don't send that tweet, please. But you had, the estimates are 80 to 85% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. And there was a lot of discussion about what utter hypocrisy. These people are voting for this, you know, multiply divorced, pagan figure who has troubles with impulse control. He is a creature of the sexual revolution. And how can you support him? I take that as evangelicals and the religious right's acceptance of political realities. They're not at the center of American culture and society, and they're not going to be for any time in the near future. They're simply willing to take what political advantages they can find.
Okay, it sounds like, as with so many people on the Christian right, Bauerlein held his nose and voted for Trump rather than a person who represented more of the same.
There is some of that, but I think also for Bauerlein, there was a sense that Trump was in many ways superior to the other, whatever it was, 70 or 80 Republican candidates during the primary, a sense that precisely because he was willing to violate all these political taboos, he was able to kind of shake up not just the Republican field, but the way in which we talk. That's the paradox here, and I think something you've definitely seen among a lot of religious conservatives is a sense that there are so many kind of liberal taboos that constrain what we can say and what we can think and that actually end up being a threat. And so in his view, perhaps other Republican candidates were too mild.
Again, I'm on college campuses. It's the world of triggers and microaggressions. It has become a culture of a hermeneutic of suspicion about people. We're so unforgiving about the stupid things that we all do. Our lesser natures get the better of us. If you and I spend a week together, I'm going to say something that's going to offend you. I'm going to.
I'd like to think I'd probably say more than a few things that would offend you,
and,
too.
And you know, you just say, we're of course we're going to. And then we get past it because
right.
There's something else. But Trump exploded that hypersensitivity, that overweening awareness of identity markers. What is Donald Trump? He breaks the taboos. Now, on the social issues, millennials in particular are fierce about racism. They regard it as the sin.
Yes.
For them to see someone say, all these Mexican rapists, that crosses a taboo of race. And so it really is as if some extraordinary desecration were taking place right in front of them, and no one is doing anything about it.
And do you take some pleasure in the maybe unlikely fact that in this situation, you find yourself on the side of the desecrators?
Well, you don't want to ridicule these people who are genuinely upset. But what you want to do is say, listen, the tension you're talking here about that Donald Trump has raised because he has broken these taboos, the taboos have become destructive to our society. We're losing the liberalism. The liberalism is endangered that everyone subscribes to, conservatives and liberals too. The liberalism, I mean, that gives people a little space to think some bad thoughts. You've got to adjust your expectations here about human beings. You are utopians on human conduct. And there's a point at which the desire to make people behave is going to turn into coercion that goes too far.
Do you think that's an issue that resonates as widely for those people who aren't university professors?
I mean, I think in being in the campus zone, it exaggerates your sense of that. I think it's true. But I will say that everyone across America now has a sense of the campus as a place in which the social issues are reaching a saturation point of the ridiculous. They all watch Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and hear Rush Limbaugh on the right, and then Bill Maher, who is just as withering toward the college campuses as Bill O'Reilly is.
Yes.
Americans who've never gone to college, who may be 50 years old, who are working class, they just look at the campus and they say, you believe what's going on?
Now, I gotta say, he's a white man, mm-hmm. straight, well-employed. No one's painted a swastika on his car.
Not so far as we know.
Is he the right guy to tell others, don't be so sensitive?
Well, that whole question of, are you the right guy to say X, Y, and Z, to someone like him, that's precisely the problem. And again, I think he sees that the problem is that a certain way of talking about these issues, in his view, it relies on kind of shame and guilt to get people not to say things that they feel. And his view is that when you do that, you then inevitably create a reaction where people want to say things and people want to say the most outrageous things possible. You know, Bauerlein has a view that Trump's promise is that he can speak in an inclusive way about America, which he kind of does in his own way, but that he can do it without appealing to this notion of guilt, which Bauerlein sees as being, you know, kind of everywhere in our political discourse.
It's one of the characteristics of political conversations among liberals and progressives in the Obama era was you had what I think of as a kind of English majorification of the political discourse, where so much of the political talk among liberals, among progressives, was kind of symbols and about rhetoric and about what words people were using. And there strikes me that one of the ironies here is that often when we're talking about Trump, and you and I are talking about Trump right now, we find ourselves doing a similar thing. We find ourselves talking a lot about what he says, how he says it, what words he uses, and talking hardly at all about policies. I mean, this is the president-elect, and it's easy to talk about him without even mentioning what his policies might be.
You're right about that. People don't pay attention to policy. Part of this is because policies don't quite get down to meanings. Martin Luther King didn't say, "I have a policy." No, he said, "I have a dream." Republicans, they talk about tax rates. Okay, tax rates never, they don't excite people. I mean, the wall. Who would think, "I'm going to build a wall"? What do you mean who's going to build the wall? How are you going to contract for it? What is Mexico going to do? All the policy details. What it's really about is, this is our country. This is our home. This is our home. It's going to have a boundary. I think that is really about a feeling of, this is my place. It's harder for so many of them to believe that the more globalist, internationalist perspective is something that gives them a feeling of home.
Bauerlein here sounds pretty dismissive of policy as such.
I mean, I suspect that part of what he's reacting to is recent elections, right? Is the idea that John McCain or Mitt Romney talking about things that do resonate among conservatives didn't really excite voters. And so there's part of it is maybe an acceptance that you need more bluster. You need to speak like the way Donald Trump does. And really, Bauerlein takes the long view. You know, he's alert to the ironies of history and the ways in which all the things we do have all these unintended consequences. And he admits that the consequences of Trump's presidency will also be unintended, even for someone like him who's relatively speaking a supporter. And he cites Hegel's idea about the right person coming along at the right moment in history.
But remember, Donald Trump, this is the key question. Donald Trump has been around for 25 years as a celebrity figure. He's flirted with being president two or three times in the past, and it's always laughed off the stage. Now, Donald Trump hasn't changed. Why this time? Why in 2016 it all clicked, right? It starts making you think like a Hegelian or a Marxist in terms of historical forces somehow coming together, and one person seems right for this moment.
He's the world historical figure.
He's the world historical figure.
In Hegelian terms.
That's right. Now, this is where I think we need theorists of social ritual to understand this kind of figure who, you know, in some folk traditions, the figure who always says the wrong thing, who does the wrong thing, the fool figure in medieval courts, who has this capacity to say the thing that shouldn't be said, but that everyone hears and knows it kind of needs to be said. That's how I look at this. And I won't be surprised if on many issues, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton would not have been that far apart in their performance as president.
That was Mark Bauerlein talking to Kelly Fasana.